Hello, and welcome to the Lies.com podcast for Friday, June 2nd. I haven't been talking much politics in the podcast lately. You get to a point where you feel there's not much more to say, but news does continue to evolve, and I posted on Lies.com about this recent story to come out. I mean, it's not a recent event, but the story about it is recent, about the civilian massacre in Haditha in Iraq by a group of Marines. As many as 24 civilians killed in the aftermath of a roadside bombing, whereby all accounts some subset of the Marines at the scene basically went house to house and executed people, including unarmed women and children, with definite shades of My Lai in terms of the broad outlines of the story. I went back and did some reading up on the specifics of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, and you know, certainly the My Lai massacre was a more extreme example of this kind of thing. More people were killed, and there was a more significant cover-up effort. And as I said in my posting at Lies.com, I'm not trying to say that that the situations are identical. They're just very similar in certain respects. And I was really pretty shocked in the comments on the item I posted on Lies.com. A couple of the site's more politically conservative readers, Craig and TRG, TRG34221, I think is the full name, but I just think of him as TRG. Both came in and had similar comments about how unseemly it was for Jack Murtha, the Democrat congressman from Pennsylvania, to make all these high-profile statements condemning the Marines' actions prior to their having actually been tried and convicted. TRG had a comment this morning on the post and Lies about, you know, how they have a presumption, that the Marines have a presumption of innocence, and Murtha is somehow violating that presumption of innocence. And TRG goes farther and says that, you know, he's engaged in grandstanding political propaganda for his left-wing extremist views or something like that. And it's just, I mean, it's clearly factually wrong to argue that Jack Murtha is some kind of leftist ideologue. He's a former Marine colonel. He was, for a long time, arguably the Defense Department's biggest booster in the Democratic Party in Congress. And by all credible accounts, the turn against the Iraq War that he's been leading lately is not, I mean, it's the opposite of political opportunism that TRG accuses him of. It's obviously politically costly, you know, at a time when Democrats generally have been afraid, because of the political ramifications, to stand up to Bush's policies with respect to Iraq. Murtha went out there and was the first to call for essentially an immediate withdrawal from the country of U.S. forces. And he came to that position, again, by all credible accounts, based on his heartbreak over visiting the constant stream of maimed soldiers at Walter Reed Hospital. That this is a former Marine himself, a person who strongly identifies with the troops in the field, and he's articulating this position not out of some craven political opportunism, but out of a sincere, heartfelt concern for the well-being of the people actually serving in the military, and the recognition that they're engaged in a foolish mission, that the only reason they're still there is to allow George Bush to preserve the illusion that he was right to order them in the first place and avoid having to acknowledge his mistakes, which of course is anathema to Bush. know, from prior experience, I assume that TRG's comments are basically just repeating the right-wing talking points that get put out on conservative talk radio and conservative TV programs. He's made statements before that, to me, sound very factually suspect and seem to move in lockstep with sort of the larger right-wing echo chamber's current talking points. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for what TRG did in the wake of the Katrina situation and the comments by Aaron Broussard, the parish president of St. Bernard Parish, or maybe he's not St. Bernard Parish president, but concerning the nursing home deaths in St. Bernard Parish in Louisiana, where Broussard basically went on Meet the Press and made his big high-profile meltdown where he was in tears and he was saying, you know, for God's sakes, bring us somebody, and the story about his emergency services manager's mother being trapped in a nursing home and calling for help on Monday, on Tuesday, mama, mama, and that all turned out to be a very exaggerated story. I mean, basically, the specific sequence of events that Broussard recounted was a lie. The emergency services manager's mother died the day after the flooding. She died like on Sunday or Monday. And his account of these tearful phone calls between the manager and his mama over the course of 4 or 5 days subsequently, where she was begging for help and she died on Thursday or died on Friday or whatever it was he said, it was basically a lie. I mean, he was taking a true tragedy and fictionalizing it in order to make a political point. You know, actually engaging in the kind of political grandstanding in order to manipulate public opinion that TRG accuses Jack Murtha of doing in this case. And, you know, in that case, I got caught up in that whole issue and was very interested in, you know, this question of was Broussard lying or not. And ended up, I mean, I think TRG, I mean, there was this chain of events that led to Broussard coming back for a subsequent appearance on Meet the Press where Tim Russert cited bloggers, you know, cited the internet bloggers as having brought out this issue that, you know, the actual timeline of events at the nursing home couldn't be reconciled with Broussard's tearful account of it. And Broussard went into, you know, yet another tearful meltdown in which he accused Russert of attacking him and the people attacking him of having sick black hearts or twisted hearts or some over-the-top rhetoric like that. But I'm convinced that second appearance, that was just more of the same. That was more acting. This is, you know, this is Southern politics, a Southern demagogue working a crowd. And actually kind of impressive in that sense, just as theater and spectacle, but certainly not impressive from the standpoint of honesty. But the actual sequence of events, I think I've talked about this on lies.com, but I'll mention it briefly. I was going to talk about, I was thinking about it because I'm still working on the magnum opus of lies.com postings, the 10th anniversary lies.com reader, where I'm going back and giving commentary on my favorite items. And there's a section in there where I talk about this whole Aaron Broussard incident. But basically what happened is TRG, who described himself as being in emergency services, or I'm not sure if he's currently works in some sort of emergency services capacity or formerly did, but he was interested in some of the stories coming out of the Katrina aftermath as a result of that. And, you know, I had posted some comments about, I had posted an item on Lies where I questioned whether Broussard was telling the truth or not. And without making any accusation, just, you know, I was just curious. And TRG started, in his comments on that and other items on the site, started posting local news items that were available on the net. So these were like, you know, local news stories from different locations, but basically started to piece it together. And as he posted these items, I was involved at that point in editing a page for Aaron Broussard on Wikipedia. you know, after his appearance on Meet the Press, that first appearance, which was just this emotional highlight of the, you know, this amazing emotional highlight of the aftermath and the accusations of federal slowness in their response. And there was an item on Wikipedia, you know, a biographical item showed up, a real brief one, talking about Aaron Broussard and this appearance on Meet the Press. Well, I started editing that item to add some of these comments about, some of these other sources that basically called into question the details of what he had done, or what he had said, this story he had presented about the dying mother. And as TRG was feeding me more items, and I was editing that page on Wikipedia, eventually a right-wing blogger from wasadem.com, John at wasadem, I guess, he, reading those items, he ended up posting an accusation on his weblog that he basically referenced. I mean, he basically came across that information at the Wikipedia article. So it was basically TRG's original research as filtered through me into the Aaron Broussard article at Wikipedia as reposted by wasadem that suddenly really sparked this big outcry. And then wasadem's posting got linked to by all the right-wing webloggers. And it was sort of interesting to me to see the way this played out. I'd been talking on lies.com about this issue for a while. And from a readership standpoint, I'd be willing to bet that lies.com actually has at least as much readership as wasadem, if not more. But obviously my readership tends to be more, you know, people who are closer to my views on things, which includes a lot of people who are basically sympathetic to Broussard's account. So there wasn't really any traction there. You know, I was posting this stuff pointing out that he was obviously lying. But, you know, the people in the right-wing blogosphere don't read lies.com, and they didn't come across it until wasadem found it on Wikipedia. So by having Wikipedia, having this sort of neutral ground where information, you know, there's this whole NPOV policy, this neutral point of view policy at Wikipedia, you know, it kind of becomes this demilitarized zone between the left-wing and right-wing blogosphere. And on a politically charged story like this one, you know, I was able to get that story out into the larger world, or TRG was able to get that story out into the larger world by sending it through. It's sort of like money laundering. You know, you take your ideas and you put them through this filter to strip away the more blatantly partisan aspects of it and just get down to the bare facts. And by putting that on Wikipedia, it then found its way to the ideologues on the other side, who then picked up the story and ran with it and made a big deal about it, which led to Tim Russert citing the internet bloggers in his questioning in the follow-up interview with Broussard. So that was the closest lies.com has ever come to having a high-profile mention on a national TV show. So even though it was several steps removed, it gave me kind of a warm, squishy feeling of excitement. But I bring all that up as kind of background on my sense of gratitude to TRG for having provided that information. And I tend to try and cut him some slack, at least mentally, when I see him coming out with right-wing talking points, as he's done a couple of times since then on the site. But, you know, really in this case, yeah, I'm sure there's an element of truth to the argument that Murtha at this point is making a political case against the war. I don't think he's trying to conceal that. And as someone who's been opposed to the war from the outset, I don't see anything wrong with that. I think it's just rational and moral to take that position. But TRG is definitely over the top in describing Murtha as some leftist ideologue, because he's not. You know, he's, if anything, a right-of-center Democrat in terms of the larger body of what he's done throughout his career. And again, I think it's clear if you actually look at the evidence that the position he's taking lately on the war in Iraq is, you know, if it's right or wrong, it's a position he's arrived at not out of some political calculation, but out of a heartfelt desire to do what he thinks is right, and a willingness to do that even if it costs him politically, as I think it has. The one other aspect of this whole Haditha massacre aftermath I want to mention is just the really strong sense I got, not just from TRG, who I know is prone to this kind of stuff, but from Craig chiming in with similar criticisms of Murtha in the immediate aftermath of my first posting about it, is this sense of just the I can't think of any other term to describe it except the moral relativism of the right wing these days. You know, moral relativism was this phrase that became popular, I guess, during the Reagan era. Or maybe it was later. Maybe it was a Newt Gingrich term that he popularized more. But it was this notion that, you know, it was a backlash against the left gaining ascendancy in academia, you know, gaining ascendancy among professors on college campuses, and that in the social sciences especially, and that's, you know, I got a political science degree from UCLA in 1985, so I was definitely steeped in the academic social sciences for a few years there. And so I recognize the truth of a lot of what this is talking about, but this notion that the position in academia that is basically that there's moral relative, that it's, what am I trying to say, that the moral relativism of academia, actually, wasn't it a Jeannie Kirkpatrick phrase? I think maybe that's where this originated or first came to my attention, was Jeannie Kirkpatrick in the 80s, you know, in the Reagan administration. She was Reagan's ambassador to the UN or representative to the UN, and she was involved in a high-profile way in talking about our policies in Central America under Reagan, framing the support of the Contras, who are basically, you know, mercenaries and murderers who are being funded to go in and try and destabilize the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole U.S. role in Latin America debate. There was this charge of moral relativism that the academics, that leftist academics were guilty of moral relativism, that it was this sense of not having any real moral center to their arguments, that they were willing to say that right and wrong had to be judged in terms of, it had to be judged separately, had to be judged differently in different situations, and that basically it was a criticism from the right that the left was using some sort of sliding scale of morality so that the left could shift the terms of the debate and criticize the U.S. for engaging in actions that the left would then turn around and excuse when committed by leftist regimes, such that, you know, you'd criticize the Contras for burning villages or killing civilians, but you'd excuse the same activity by the Sandinista army, or I'm not sure, you know, it's, or that you'd criticize the government of Nicaragua, the U.S.-backed government, I mean, of El Salvador, you'd criticize the U.S.-backed government of El Salvador for ties to death squads, but you'd excuse the death squad-like activities of the insurgency or the revolutionary cells, the anti-government leftist forces in El Salvador. I don't know. I'm probably not giving a real fair characterization, but that was the general idea, that the underlying argument was that it was that morality, to have any meaning, had to apply no matter who you were talking about. That if something was, if you're going to make this moral case, if you're going to talk about sort of absolutes of right and wrong, then it couldn't matter. You weren't allowed to have it make a difference who was actually committing the acts. Different people performing the same actions, if the actions were wrong, they were equally wrong, regardless of who was doing them. And this makes, you know, intuitive sense, that if your morality is really to have any kind of power to it, any kind of substance to it, you know, it's the act itself that's wrong or right. It's not, the morality of the act itself doesn't change just because somebody you like is engaged in it. And, you know, that was a criticism that in some cases I believe was valid, you know, that the left was guilty of that. But what's clear with the Bush administration and what's clear with the reactions of the right-wing echo chamber lately with these marine massacres in Haditha and elsewhere coming to light, and charges that, you know, the real outrage here is not that, I mean, I'll paraphrase what Craig said, and you should go read it on the site if you really care, because I'm not going to really be doing it justice. I mean, he's a thoughtful guy, and he made a thoughtful comment, but the takeaway message I got from it was basically that, you know, it was understandable, if unfortunate, that Marines in this terrible situation would sometimes step across this line with all this killing going on all around them and their buddy just being blown up by a roadside bomb. It was understandable if they got emotional and maybe were guilty of some excess, and, you know, not to forgive it, but just to understand it in context. You know, you have to realize that's what's going on there. but that Murtha is coming out and using his presumed access to non-public results of Marine investigations, Defense Department investigations into the incident, for him to go public with that and make these very far-reaching criticisms in public is a real moral outrage, is a really bad thing, you know, and in the context, to me, that just seems so out of proportion that, you know, you can basically excuse this story about Marines going into homes and shooting mothers and children, you know, little girls, seven-year-old girls. You know, you're going to shoot a seven-year-old girl in the head as she kneels on the floor. You know, I don't see any way to excuse that. I don't see any way to treat that as, you know, I was just watching Pulp Fiction the other night, and the whole conversation with John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson in the early scene where they're in the hallway before they go in and take on all the kids in the room, and they're talking about it doesn't matter what they're talking about, but the whole question, you know, Samuel L. Jackson's comment that A and B are not in the same ballpark, they're not even the same sport. I'm not doing justice at all intentionally there to the language that Samuel L. Jackson uses in that scene, which is just a great scene. But not to get off the track, you know, that you would have any moral outrage to bring against Jack Murtha for his actions in exposing some of what's going on in the Haditha aftermath, and have virtually nothing to say about the moral consequences or the moral status of what the Marines did in the first place, is so incredibly out of whack to me. I mean, that's not even the same sport. And it just reveals to me that, you know, anybody who's carrying water for the Bush administration and its policies in Iraq at this point and is making those kinds of arguments is so guilty of moral relativism, of applying a different moral standard based on whether, you know, the person's actions, whether the person performing the actions in question is on your side or the other side, that there's just, I mean, there is no solid moral ground in there at all. I mean, that's just such a squishy, amorphous mass of self-serving would-be morality that it really just leaves me breathless and speechless, which is why I will now stop ranting at length about it. So now I remember why I haven't been talking about politics lately, because I end up just going off forever on this long rant about it. I've been doing some more birding. Had an interesting, to me, experience with posting some observations to the Santa Barbara County birding list, SBCO birding at Yahoo Groups, and posted about having seen blue grosbeaks, which I mentioned in my last podcast, I think, at the Carpinteria Bluffs, and also mentioned watching the white-tailed kites at the Carpinteria Bluffs, and got a response from a few different well-known local birders who were interested in follow-up information on that I think it's Mark Holmgren and Jim Greaves, I think, and then Peter Gaeta, all three of them being well-known, local, awesome birders. Peter I've actually birded with several times and really enjoyed those experiences. But they all wrote back with follow-up questions about what I'd seen and expressing interest in more observations. So I've been getting more interested in that, seeing whether the blue grosbeaks are actually going to be breeding at the Carpinteria Bluffs this year. I saw a male there. I saw, you know, a group of them. I saw, I think, three males and a female there about a month ago. And then subsequently heard a male singing at the Bluffs. And Linda, on a separate trip to the Bluffs, saw a blue grosbeak. And then Sunday I went and saw a single male singing there. And then Wednesday evening, spent about 90 minutes there, and saw a female in the same area of the Bluffs. So, Peter said that, that he'd been told that last year Lou Grosbeak's actually bred at the Bluffs, but he wanted to try and document that behavior this year, if possible, if they actually are establishing breeding territory there. So that gives me something interesting to do on my weekends. I can go walk the Bluffs and look in particular for the blue grosbeaks. And of course the white-tailed kites. Peter mentioned that people are interested in successful feeding behavior. They want to know if the kites are hunting there and if they're actually eating anything, and if so, you know, documenting that. So that gives me something interesting to keep track of, although I've never needed an excuse to watch the white-tailed kite. Pretty much is my favorite bird ever, which is deducible if you're, I don't think anybody is, but if you're obsessive enough about John Calendar trivia to know that I own the website Elanis.net, the domain name Elanis.net, and that's actually where I hosted the website for the book I wrote. Pearl for Website Management was under Elanis.net. And that Elanis lucurus is the scientific name of the white-tailed kite. So that's why I registered that name, which was kind of funny in a way, because I registered Elanis.net thinking, oh, what a cool name. Yeah, I'll be, Elanis Networks will be my business name for my consulting business. And I was all excited about that. I thought, wow, what a cool association. And it wasn't until just after I actually got the name registered and got the website set up that I looked at it and realized, you know, that actually looks like a name you'd register for Mexican pornography, or Spanish language pornography, elanis.net. And having once seen that, I couldn't get that out of my head. So I've ended up not using that domain for too much, although I still have it, because it's the address that's in the published version of the book, so it's worth keeping that address up rather than having it go stale. I still like it, even if it has that sort of odd association. There's this sort of odd paradox to web logging and podcasting and activities like that. You know, I talked a little bit last time about the semi-existence of Brian, this early online diary. And, whoa. Sorry. Things are flying off the car in front of me and landing on the road. I had a bunch of paintings on the roof of his SUV, and they just all came, or one, a couple of them came flying off and landed in the highway. And it happened right in front of me and almost caused an accident. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes, the odd paradox between, that line and the semi-existence of Brian, the very first posting he ever put up, was basically talking about how he decided that he was going to let you all into my life, by which he meant he was going to just keep this diary online on the web and let anybody read it. And there is this odd dynamic to podcasting or web logging in terms of divulging personal information. You know, it's a little bit like, I guess, a confessional, you know, the Catholic confession, which I don't have any personal experience with, but this idea that, you know, you've got this situation in which you can say things that you wouldn't normally say, in the knowledge that you're telling it to someone, but there's this sense of being protected or isolated. It's not like you're revealing it in a water cooler conversation at work, because you're just talking to, you know, in this case, I'm talking to a microphone by myself in a car. So there's, I think, or, you know, posting it on a weblog, there's a tendency to say things. I mean, the question is, who are you actually talking to when you're weblogging or podcasting? And, you know, there's a, on one level, it's compelling, I think, to make these connections, these interpersonal connections to people that you wouldn't otherwise meet or hear from, and get the personal details. I mean, the weblogs I find interesting, or the things I find interesting about my favorite weblogs, in part, is these little personal touches. You know, it's learning about the individual person at the other end. But at the same time, you know, it's not a private conversation. You know, anything you say on a weblog or in a podcast and put out there on the internet, you're basically publishing that information for anyone to read. So I'm saying all this because I'm having this little inner debate on, you know, I'm talking about events in my life and I'm talking about things going on, and I went to the doctor this week for a medical procedure that, you know, I'm not advertising. I'm not out there talking to people at work about it. And I thought, well, should I talk about it in the podcast? And on one level, I'm like, you know, no, I don't really want to talk about that. On another level, I'm like, well, why not? You know, if someone's listening to this, it's because they're interested in the things I talk about, at least to some degree. Maybe it's interesting to people, I don't know. And then it's also, well, I'll just talk about it, and then I'll make my observations afterwards, rather than doing it backwards as I was doing. So for years now, have been, you know, theoretically prepared to get a vasectomy. You know, I thought this is something that, you know, Linda has borne the brunt of the health risks of our birth control methods for many years now, and we're not going to have more kids. I'm 44, and looking at the associated health risks, you know, it seems like this is something that I should do, and this is something I'm prepared to do, and I'm finally followed through on it this week. So I went and had a consultation at the urologist's office Wednesday, and it was interesting in talking to Linda afterwards that, you know, it's such a contrast. This is such a man's world in many ways, at least in the healthcare system. The comparison, you know, and Linda, you know, was laughing about this and talking about it. If you picture, you know, what a woman goes through in terms of an OBGYN visit, she goes to, you know, she may go to an office and she's led to a room and she takes off her pants and she sits up on this examining table and puts herself up in stirrups and she's basically exposed to the world as completely and in the most humiliating fashion imaginable and left in that position for anybody to walk in the door and see what's going on. And, you know, and then this male doctor walks in who she maybe hasn't even seen so far, and he's just whipping through on his assembly line of seeing all these women prepared for him. And, you know, it's what it is. It's not like I'm making a big outraged case that this is a terrible thing. But this is, you know, pretty much par for the course. I mean, if it's not universal, it's at least very familiar that this is the experience that women have, that they get used to from an early age in terms of, you know, dealing with health issues related to their reproductive organs. And contrast that with my experience. Now, you know, for years I've been putting off actually having this visit, in large part, in all honesty, because of my squeamishness at the notion that I'm going to have to give a sperm sample in a doctor's office, that I'm going to go in there and I'm going to get handed a cup and sent to some room and told, okay, you know, we need you to provide a sperm sample. And just this arrested development emotionally that I deal with in so many different areas, this notion I've still got adolescent shame in masturbation. It's not so much that people know that I'm masturbating, but that those strangers in that office know that right now I'm in that office masturbating was so aversive that I was willing to put off for, you know, 2 years at least, following through on this commitment I'd made and this, you know, position I'd logically come to, that yes, this was the appropriate thing for me to do. So finally just sucked it up and went. Well, as it turns out, you know, this situation, this particular office where they do a lot of vasectomies is totally structured to preserve the sensitive male ego from any such bruising. And the contrast with Linda's description of going to a gynecologist's office is so, I mean, it was very funny to me at the time. Just this notion that, you know, I go in there and I fill out some forms in the waiting room, and I'm led to this office, and it's like a doctor's office with a desk and diplomas on the wall and lots of books in the bookcase. It's almost like a Victorian era sitting room this place is made up as, and it's, you know, not medical at all. And I'm sit there across the desk from this guy, and he goes through the risk factors and what the procedure involves, and even makes a joke. You know, there's this comment he made at one point about how, you know, after the procedure, well, I'll need to ejaculate 25 times or so to make sure that we've cleared the semen out of the system. And he kind of glances up and says, of course, I can give you a note for that, you know, like a doctor's note, which was meant as a joke, but it was so funny because it came out in the context of this very serious presentation. So I thought that was cute. I chuckled at that. But then, you know, after he's had all this time to kind of gauge my sense of squeamishness and am I ready for this, then he's like, okay, well, we'll go to the examining room, and, you know, ostensibly he's going to show me how I need to shave my scrotum for the procedure. So he's going to, you know, basically this is where he actually examines my penis and scrotum, and he has me take my pants down. But we go in this room, and it's done, you know. It's just the whole experience was so carefully tailored to be as non-threatening as possible. It was very funny to compare it with what Linda described going through. And I didn't have to masturbate in the office. And, you know, they basically didn't need a before sperm sample. And for the after sperm samples that they need, they've said, well, you know, you can just do it at home and then bring it in. So all my stress for no particular reason. And I don't know that any of you really wanted to hear all that, but it's one of the interesting things that's happened in my life, and I couldn't, in good conscience, exclude that while telling you about all the other trivia going on. So, a week from next Wednesday, my vas deferens will be cut and cauterized and placed into separate planes. All this stuff I learned about during my consultation. After which I will have a certain amount of discomfort and swelling, which hopefully only lasts for a day or two. But, you know, in filling out the medical history, I realized that I've been extraordinarily fortunate from a medical history standpoint. I've only had one significant medical procedure, really, in my life. I mean, one operation. Only once was I ever under general anesthesia, and this is going to be under local anesthesia. But the only time I was ever under general anesthesia was for my wisdom tooth extraction, which ended up going horribly wrong and led to a nasty post-operative infection. And there's a story I don't want to revisit right now, not to spare you, but mainly to spare me. And also, I have reached that point where my battery is about to give out. So I want to tell you that this copyrighted podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons license. Please see my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. I am John Callender, and if you made it through that whole vasectomy discussion, I want to thank you especially much for listening.